Welcome to episode 22 of All of Your Business. These are the vulnerable, authentic, and unfiltered stories of business owners whose currents raise tides that lift all of our businesses, communities, and dreams. Before we get started, we are proud to announce that All of Your Business podcast has received a 2020 X-Ray Podcast Award presented by X-Ray FM. X-Ray FM, purpose-driven media at 91.1 FM and 107.1 FM, and find them online at xray.fm. On this episode, we're pleased to welcome Kevin Cook, a.k.a. Poison Waters, and now executive producer and host, Michael Jonas.
First of all, thank you so much for doing the podcast. I really appreciate it.
Sure. Sorry it didn't work out to be in person and all the other good stuff.
No, I know. Well, this is a time for Zoom. Life is on Zoom. So hopefully it's not just another Zoom call. You actually have a break from your Zoom calls to enjoy your life and do whatever.
Right.
So I have questions for you, of course, because that's the way these things go. But, you know, of course, it's a conversation, too. So the first thing I wanted to ask you is kind of relating to the question I had in the email. You know, what do people call you? Like, do people call you Kevin? Do people call you Poison? Is it depending on, like, what you're wearing?
No, they call me both all the time, regardless. It's all interchangeable at this point. I've been doing Poison Waters for 33 years, so I think people just... all blurs together. There's some people who have never worked with me as Poison, so they only call me Kevin, and some people who've only worked with me as, some people only, regardless of how I'm dressed, some people only call me Kevin because that's how they know me. And there's times when I'm only called Poison by, I'll say, you know, show people or industry people, even if I'm not in drag, just because that's how they know me.
Yeah. And so you just know to answer to both.
Yes, I do.
Okay, and then you're from Portland, right? Like, you're from the area.
Yes, okay, so sorry. I just had to wrap that up and sit for stand so they'll leave me alone for our time together. Now I'm focused on you, sorry. My family moved here in 1979. We are from Southern California originally. And then I lived 2 years in New Mexico before moving here in 79, and I've been here ever since.
Yeah. And, you know, everyone talks about like Portland changing. I'm from California who moved north. And I tell Andy, like, people can make fun of that, but then you wouldn't have had a boyfriend or, you know, because everyone thinks that people from California that move north are like buying properties left and right or like making Portland into some Orange County, whatever. So, right. I guess what's your thought on that? Like, how has Portland changed since you were a child?
Well, I think, you know, when we first came in 79, it was this thing, like people called it the Great Migration North. Everybody was coming from California to Oregon. There weren't a lot of jobs. That's when, you know, gas was rare and, you know, scarce and jobs were scarce. So people came to Oregon, especially Portland, as like, the new frontier, so to speak. There were just opportunities here that weren't afforded to folks in California at the time. And so I don't know that yes, everybody blames Californians. And I even think, you know, when I first moved here, people didn't really say, because it was all those dirty Californians. And so people really were kind of like, oh, where'd you come from? And we were thankful we could say, oh, we lived in New Mexico, because we did, but just for a little bit before we came here. So I think, you know, I bet every city, you know, Portland's not a major city. So any like-sized city could probably say the same thing and probably is having the same conversations. Oh, our city's changed. You know, things grow. Things, you know, modernization happens. Things come and go. You know, the neighborhoods change when the highways change. You know, neighborhoods were removed or shifted because the highway was coming through. Well, everybody benefits from those highways. We went from just I-5 to then a wider I-5 and now 205 and all those. And then, you know, the 84 freeway. And then, of course, the transit when you're building, you know, max lines and whatnot. So everybody's talking about, oh, there's so much construction and regentrification and all that stuff. And there definitely have been changes. Neighborhoods that used to be called, you know, the undesirable neighborhoods are now the hip, swanky neighborhoods. So I think people got bought out and pushed out, and now people can't afford to move and live in those neighborhoods.
Yeah, like the numbers in Gresham is like a place people want to go now. It's desirable.
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, in even kind of on that note, so when we first moved here, I lived in East County. So we went to Park Rose High School and Park Rose schools there. So East County, that was kind of like the boonies. No one wanted to live out there. And that was only like, you know, 102nd to 181st. Well, now people live out in the 350 whatevers. And they're, you know, so there definitely has been growth and expansion. You know, downtown's different. The skyline's different. I think there's more opportunities in the arts and culture sector of our city, which is great. And so I think, you know, things have changed, and I don't know that they're all for the bad. So I think, first of all, if you start talking to people and have these conversations, my favorite thing is saying, oh, so are you born and raised here? And you are hard-pressed to find a born and bred Portlander. So most of the people that are complaining are just complaining because they got here sooner than we did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, where did the people go that were from Portland?
I think they just moved further out, you know, to the East County. And also I think, you know, families kind of, this sounds terrible, the families just kind of, you know, die off, you know, and then the kids, you know, if the grandparents are gone or the aunts and uncles are gone, the kids are like, well, I'm going off to college. And they find that, you know, Portland isn't the big booming metropolis that, you know, we're led to believe in junior high and high school. And so I think a lot of folks, when they go off to college, you know, they find that they have a new life wherever they went to school, or if they've fallen in love and found somebody, they end up going to where that person's from.
Yeah. Well, and I know, like you mentioned, people moving further out, and I know there's gentrification. There was the whole area where they were supposed to build the hospital and, you know, basically tore down houses. So I guess you're probably somewhere in the middle. Like, the city has to grow, but we also have to be careful and kind and have a plan and not just be destructive.
Yeah, and I honestly don't believe that we've been overly destructive without a plan. I think sometimes not everybody agrees with the plan. And, you know, it's a democracy. We vote for the folks to sit in these positions and have these offices and hold these positions. So we have to just trust that the people that we voted for are going to work in our best interest. Of course, that's not always true, but it can't be everybody doesn't have a, you know, everybody can't weigh in on it. Although a lot of these major projects do, the city council does have open forum meetings and opportunities, town halls for the community to come together. I remember in the mid to late 80s, the Gateway Fred Meyer over on 102nd and Halsey, it got a huge, massive overhaul, and they were making it. It was going to be so cool, and there was a lot of houses there in that neighborhood. There was already an existing store, but they wanted to really make it gigantic and have the parking lot and all this stuff. And for years, and I haven't been out there for a while, but once they finally revealed, unveiled the whole new beautiful thing, there was one corner that sat this old house, because those people would not sell. They, you know, all the other houses, it's not like they just kick you out of your house and knock it down. You know, it's your home that you own if you're the homeowner. So people are giving, an offer, I'll say, to buy the home. And I know that some folks have gone, you know, back and forth negotiations, like, well, I'll move, but how bad do you want me to move? You know, I'll get. So for some people, it did offer them, you know, afford them a new life to take this money and run, so to speak. But I remember that one house, they're like, you know what, I'm not selling, I'm not moving. And that was forever in my mind, like, wow, I guess, you know, some people can't be bought. And if somebody really wants to keep their house and keep their property, and, you know, homes are, you know, handed down throughout families, and this family said nope. And so I always loved that. So
yeah, no, that's really cool. Yeah, and I think, because, you know, with the government, there's eminent domain, but Fred Meyer is a private company, so they can try to be as big as they want, but you're absolutely right. Someone says no, someone says no.
Yep, so, that little house, those little homeowners said, heck no, we're staying.
So what was your childhood like? I know that's kind of a broad question, but, you know, growing up, like, do you have fond memories? What were you like?
I have mixed memories. I am what I like to call myself the middle child, except there's four of us. So people always say, how are you the middle child? So I have one older sister and two younger brothers. So we were all born in Southern California and all came here together. As I said, my mother and father separated like right after I was born. So I don't even have any memories of him at all. And then my mother remarried, and then her and her new husband had two more children. So my father is Black and my mother's Mexican Native American. So my sister and I are the same nationality. My mother's new husband was Caucasian. So my two little brothers are half Caucasian and a quarter Mexican and a quarter Native American. So growing up, there was definitely a visual difference between my sister and I, my two little brothers. And so my sister being the oldest, and she's the only girl, and then my two little brothers being our new father's biological children, I just automatically felt like the odd man out. So, and I won't say that I didn't put myself in that position. I think there were dynamics within the family, and that put me there. And then, of course, myself knowing from an early age that I was different. Of course, my family caught on too, you know, that I was gay and there was something different about Kevin. So I kind of was, but I say I'm the middle child of four. So my family, the whole time growing up until I left house after high school, was extremely poor. My parents worked, you know, the best they could, but they just never got, I don't want to say the break they needed. I remember my mother taking several different jobs. My stepfather, not so much. He was alcoholic and abusive and not the greatest of fellas. So we lived in poverty, and we benefited greatly from all the social services, the different organizations, be it government or religious or just local groups that helped with clothing and food and rent assistance and all those things, you know, food stamps and welfare. So all those things that people hear about and read about, I experienced firsthand my entire growing up. So I found that I could be, you know, down in the dumps about my situation, or I could just try to make the best of it. I've always been a personable person. So in school, from a young age, I was always, you know, very social. I've always been more mature for my age, I think, because I just kind of decided that I needed to be, that I needed to take care of myself. And so I always had great relationships with my teachers and my advisors and that sort of thing, which I know can come off as teacher's pet and kind of a brown noser, but it wasn't my fault. They just liked me better than the rest of the class. And so I was in, you know, took to music and band and choir and orchestra and all that good stuff to kind of keep me busy and keep me active, and all those activities, you know, helped me to, you know, I didn't have to go home right after school where it wasn't very happy at home. So I could go and do all these fun things. Also, because my family was so poor, I never had big dreams of travel and I was going to go get to do all these things. But working in the school, the arts, you know, community in our school, we got to travel with the music department and with the orchestra and band and choir. So I got the travel bug because I got to go places that I never thought I'd get to go. So I feel like I had, you know, that's why I say I have mixed memories of my childhood. I definitely have memories that aren't so pleasant, but then certainly lots of really great ones too.
Yeah. Well, and you said that you were different and your family knew, like, what did you do with that? I mean, were you very much like, this is who I am, screw you all? Did you put that, you know, energy into being artistic?
No, not really either of those things. When I say they knew, it's just because it was kind of obvious. And my, you know, there would be comments made, but nothing was addressed. I certainly didn't come out until well after I graduated high school and was living on my own. I wasn't, you know, out in high school. I never dated. I started to have a boyfriend or anything like that. So I wasn't ever really kind of like the screw you. Park Rose was a small community back then, and I definitely stood out. And so I tried to stand out for the right reasons and not the wrong reasons, as, you know, my peers would have me to believe. So I just kind of did my own thing. I mean, I I went with the crowd, you know, I did what everybody else did. And I certainly didn't try to, you know, date girls and put on that facade. I just tried to be, you know, a good person and be the best me and not, you know, I didn't even know then, like I never heard of a drag queen. I didn't know what any of that stuff was. I didn't know that there were clubs and singles, and I didn't know all the stuff that, you know, I know now. So it wasn't like I was, you know, pining away in rural Portland, wishing I could be, you know, downtown in drag, because none of that was an option for me. It wasn't ever anything in my mind. So I think, you know, high school, junior high and high school, there were definitely, you know, the bullies and the jocks and the, you know, kind of, I'll say redneck kind of folks that just didn't even know what to do with, you know, a mixed race kid who was effeminate and who was always the teacher's pet. So I think those, you know, those kind of experiences with those kind of fellas wasn't, I mean, I survived it. It wasn't, you know, as horrible as I know a lot of other folks have had it.
Yeah.
So I didn't really think, oh, I'm going to take that and put it into my music and in theater and that sort of stuff. I think I just did those programs just again because they were, I'm, you know, a personable person, outgoing. They were an opportunity to kind of, you know, show off. And again, those programs helped me to find time, ways to fill my time, so it wasn't just school and home. It got to be school and home and all my social activities.
Yeah, and what did you, I mean, I think of you just as poison, but you obviously had jobs prior to that.
Oh, yeah.
So, I mean, what were you, I picture you like, I mean, you're fabulous either in drag or out, but I'm trying to picture you like at an office day job, you know.
Well,
just,
I'll tell you,
just,
I'll give you my quick and dirty rundown. People always are surprised at my job history. So I haven't had a lot of jobs, but I do remember in high school, there were like summertime programs for kids. So one time I worked in the education department for Multnomah County in the animal control out in Troutdale. And so what that was I thought I was going to get to play with puppies all day. But in fact, I went with an adult employee, and we would go to libraries and parks and read books about animals and things to the kids. And they even had like a big puppy dog costume that I had to wear and be like the mascot and stuff. So that was kind of fun. And then I also worked at the local pizza place. A new pizza place opened up a block away from the high school, and a boy, to get a job there was, you know, a plum thing. So I was going to make my own money, and it was all good and well until somebody put the hot pan on the space where it's supposed to be the cool pan, and I picked it up and it burned my fingers, and I dropped it and I swore because I was really pissed off that somebody did put it in the wrong spot. I'm also a Virgo, so I like things a certain way. And there's clearly a place where you put the hot pans from the oven and the cool pans that are not. Anyway, and they put it in the wrong spot, and I burned my fingers, and I swore loudly, and the whole restaurant heard me, so I was fired. And then after high school, I started working at Kmart, right by Parker's High School. Again, a block away is Kmart, no more, RIP. And Kmart, oh my gosh. And I worked there for 2 years, and it was so fun. I really, really enjoyed my time at Kmart.
Blue
it was
light specials.
Oh, the blue light special. I love getting on that microphone and saying, if you look up and around, you'll see the blue light flashing. And it was really fun because I got to Park Roads again as a small community, and the Kmart, you know, there weren't a lot of Kmarts then. So people came from all over. It wasn't just Park Rose people that shopped there. I got to really, really learn about all the different types of people. And it was a great crash course in humanity. And I worked in the toy department during Christmas at Kmart. I tell you what, if you can survive that, you can survive anything. And I had wonderful coworkers, some great, really regular customers that would come in often. And then I had some really horrible experiences where people were just assholes, and they just, you know, I'm like, come on, it's Kmart, let's not get crazy here. But so I had a great time. So that was 2 years, and I finally realized I didn't want to be at Kmart forever, but I loved retail. And I found a little store called HK Limited was hiring, and they were a family store, and they probably had 5 or 7 stores around Oregon, and even down in Salem, and for a small time we had one in Eugene. And I worked at Clackamas Town Center, and it was great store. It's kind of a cross between Kitchen Caboodle and Hallmark and Made in Oregon. They just had all the kind of stuff you would want, lots of gifts, things for your home, cards and t-shirts and jewelry and all this stuff, then high-end furniture, or, you know, $2 magnets. They just kind of everything. And the slogan was, come in with nothing in mind and leave with something you love. And it was true, because people just came to our store just to come in, and then they would leave with this bizarre thing. So I love that. Again, it was kind of like the Kmart experience, where I got to meet so many different kinds of people, but I also just got to, you know, hone my personality skills, my people skills, get to see, it's a different type of people shopping at the HK Limited at Clackamas Town Center than the Kmart. And they, I was a family business, that I got to really know the family and enjoy them. And the woman that hired me was really a great mentor for a couple of years. So I ended up working with them for 5 years. And I ended up working at Clackamas Town Center, Lloyd Center, Jansen Beach, downtown. We were one of the original stores in the Pioneer Place Mall when they opened, Salem's Lancaster Mall and the Valley River Mall in Eugene. So I got to work at all of those and work my way up from just a part-time, you know, associate to a full-time store manager. And in fact, I managed 3 stores during one holiday season when we had lost a couple of employees. So, and also, side note, I don't drive. I've never driven. So I take the bus in the winter from my 3 stores, bouncing around like all during the day to check them out and make sure inventory was going on and all that stuff. So that was my my 5-year stint at HK Limited. That was going to be my career. And then I went to work for the state of Oregon Department of Environmental Quality for 12 years. If you can believe that, I worked in printing and distribution, which is a fancy word for the mailroom copy center. So we were the headquarters for the entire state of Oregon's Department of Environmental Quality, for the whole state. Their headquarters are in downtown Portland. And this is before the internet and before, you know, all of this. So everything, you know, all the statutes, the state rules about environment, everything about hazard materials and any air pollution, anything that was being sent around the state, whether it be the businesses or state agencies, schools, everything. We printed it all. So these gigantic printers, like a Xerox machine, but as big as a truck, you know, there was 2 or 3 of them in this room, and I ran those, and then all the mail for the whole state. So it was really fun. It was very casual. And I got to meet so many different people, and 12 years goes by really quick. I couldn't believe that I was in that job for so long. So all this time, I've been doing drag at night, but I always had a full-time day job. And that was kind of rare, you know, coming up in the drag scene. Most drag queens, that's just what they did, and tried to make ends meet, where I always had a job to you know, keep myself going. And then the drag was just for fun. So then I left the state to go work at Cascade AIDS Project, because I'd been volunteering for them for years and years and years. And there was a position open that sounded fun. And I thought, oh, this would be great. So I went to go work for them. And then I realized, working for a nonprofit is much different than volunteering for a nonprofit. I had just come from 12 years with the state, where I could have anything I wanted. If I needed this envelope or this pen or whatever, then you go to work for a nonprofit, and no, you just get whatever they give you. You know, I'm like, where's the supply catalog? I want fancy purple pens and, you know, fancy smelly sticky notes and all this stuff. And like, no, that's not how we do it here. So everything was a process. And I loved working with the clients at CAP and the staff at CAP, but I realized quickly I was better suited as a volunteer than an employee. And that happened at the time Portland Monthly Magazine, their owner was looking for a personal assistant, and we had worked together on some events, and she knew me from around town, and lots of folks had told her about me. And she was getting ready to open a new magazine in Seattle, and they said, you need an assistant to go back and forth with you, you can't do all this yourself. And so I did, and that was in 2005. And I still work with Portland Monthly, hosting their events and whatnot. And I've worked with them in the office capacity over this 15 or so years. So it's not a lot of jobs. I'm 52 years old, and I've just had a couple of retail jobs, the state, and then with the magazine. So if they're all varied, I kind of can do a little bit of everything. But each job, it gave me so many lessons that I didn't know. I never went to school for computers or any of that stuff. We didn't have computer class in the late 80s at Park Rose. And everything I've learned about computers, I've learned on the job with great friends who helped me and teach me. And, you know, now, of course, and everything is digital, I would be lost if I didn't have these job experiences, because now I can manage, you know, my website, and I can manage the social media, and I can work on promotional materials and work on all this kind of stuff. But I'm telling you what, when I first left high school, I didn't know how to do any of that at all. So it's all been good training for the life I live now.
Yeah, well, and I imagine, like you said, with the Kmart job, all those other jobs, you meet all kinds of people, you know, which probably aids with you being so sassy and knowing how to pull people out of the crowd. But I like when in that whole time frame did Poison come about? Was she, you know, was she a concept? And then is it, I immediately know I'm going to be Poison Waters. This is what she's going to look like. Or was it, you know, for several years, you either had a different name or you tried out different looks and then you're like, okay, this is what it's going to be. Like, kind of tell me about that.
So the process there, Michael, was it was really very simple, and it wasn't a long thought out situation. I wish I was that clever. I graduated high school and I was working at Kmart. And then well, I was going to Mount Hood Community College. I had wanted to go there just to get, you know, my feet wet in the college world before I decided what I wanted to do. And I met lots of new fun friends. And that's where I met my first gay friends. They were like out gay people my same age. And I'm like, wait, what? And so they, you know, said, hey, let's go downtown to the City Nightclub. I didn't know what that was. And I didn't even know, you know, downtown was this whole new world to me. And so the City Nightclub was a great place. I danced and met new people and saw, you know, men dancing with men. Well, we were all teenagers. So, you know, guys dancing with guys and girls dancing with girls. And it was really fantastic. And it was mind-blowing. At the same time, a little naughty and a little suspicious. But so we would go there. And at midnight, they would stop the show. Stop the dancing. I loved the dancing. All the music from the late 80s was amazing. And I would dance and dance with all my new friends, and then they would stop it and put on a show. And I hated that because, one, I didn't want to stop dancing, and two, the floor of a teenage dance club is gross. So that's where we had to sit on the floor so everybody can see the stage. So we're sitting amongst, you know, the spilled soda pop and chips and garbage, you know. That's when people would smoke cloves and all that. Anyway, so we're on the floor watching these drag shows, and I was like, eh, I wasn't really into it. I didn't think it was very entertaining coming from a, you know, a theatrical, a musical experience from high school and in college. I was like, oh, this could be so much better, you know, not even giving these folks a chance, realizing, you know, these are like kids, you know, putting this on. And one time they did the show, and it was special guests from Darcells and the Embers, which were places at that time I'd not heard of. And all of the queens in this show were black, and they all wore white, and they did a whole show with all music from the musical Dreamgirls. So all of this new stuff hit me all at once in one night, and that's when I realized one of the other reasons I didn't think about why I didn't really care for those other shows was I never saw anybody that looked like me. Mm. So to see a stage full of these beautiful drag queens, again, I remember I relate more well to older folks. So they were older because they were, you know, from the bars. They were in their 20s. And so I saw that, and they were all very glitz and glamour and sequins and rhinestones, and that spoke to me. And, my eyes caught that. Whereas the other, you know, my other drag queens of my age group, they were wearing, you know, cutoff jeans and punk rock t-shirts and whatever. So, and because I think that was either not their aesthetic to be glammy, or they just didn't have the access to those items. So I really fell in love with the show, and one of the queens was named Rosie Waters, and she said, hey, does anybody want to be a drag queen? And I just raised my hand without even thinking about it. And then we exchanged numbers. And this is, again, before cell phones and all that internet and stuff. So then we just dialed him up. And then we went to lunch. And, he said, oh, you know, what do you want to do? And where do you want to go? How does this one? And I'm like, I don't know anything about it. You tell me, I'll do what you say. So we went and got a wig, and we got a dress and got some makeup. And he would paint my face and help me teach me how to do all that. And so there was never, you know, the look that I have is literally the same look I've always had. It's just better. I mean, if you look at like my very first pictures, it's kind of the same colors, the same placement, the same everything. I just learned how to really do it. And so And it's not even like, you know, nowadays there's tutorials and all of these great makeup artists and stuff, and drag queens come out now for their first or second time looking like amazing, but that just was never my experience or my reality. And,
did you say anything like, you know, make me look like Whitney or...
No. I just always went with my own natural features. Like, I use my own eyebrows and the crease in my eyes, my own crease. Fortunately, I have large eyes. I don't really have to overdraw my lips because I have full lips. So I never really, you know, drag for some people is a complete transformation. Me, it's just kind of putting the makeup and the colors where they would naturally go on my face. Mm-hmm. And so when we got, you know, it was going to be, we did that for a week or two, played around. And he said, okay, we're going to put you in the show at the club. What is your name going to be? Of course, you can be Waters as your last name because he was Rosie Waters. And then there was Misty Waters, who was his drag mother, and she was around town. And so there was two Waters, and he said, so you'll be Waters, and then pick another name for your first name. And he said it could just be a one-word name, whatever you want it to be. And I said, okay. I went back to my job at the mall. By this time, I was working at the HK Limited, and I used to walk through the perfume counters at lunch at Nordstrom, and there was a new perfume by Christian Dior called Poison, and it smelled so good, and the bottle was this purple bottle. It looked so rich and fabulous, and so I was like, I'm going to be Poison Waters, and he did not think that was a great name, and for years, people did not think that was a great name. People were just like, you're too fun and fabulous. Why is your name Poison? That just doesn't go, but I never let it go. For some reason, I always wanted to be Poison Waters, and so that is how it all began. And it wasn't really, I don't think, much of a journey. I think the drag journey continues. I learn new stuff every day. Every time I work with new queens, I learn new stuff. I love watching drag shows, not so much to see what to do, but I like acknowledging what not to do, like behaviors and attitudes, or even things they say. I'm like, oh, note to self, never say that. You know, sometimes you think something's the most cleverest, wittiest thing, and then you hear it out of somebody else's mouth, you're like, that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and I think when I've seen you, you know, perform, I've seen you host things like galas and things like that. Like, mm-hmm. You're actually really good at talking and holding a crowd, which I don't know. I mean, no offense to other drag queens. I don't know if other drag queens could do that. I don't know if they could hold an event and a guest at that event for several hours.
Right. Well, I found out, you know, completely by accident that is my forte. And, you know, drag for most people is, you know, getting on stage and lip syncing and dancing to a number, which is a part of drag. But it's my least, I do that just because that comes with the job. But I'd rather host an event. I'd rather talk to the crowd. I love, again, I'm a Virgo, so I like to be organized. I am kind of bossy, so I like to be in charge. So being able to host an event, you know, 500 to 800 people in the Portland Art Museum, I get to stand center stage and guide the night. Like, here's what we're going to do now, and here's how we're going to do it. And I love that. And I love that I've just learned that. I think even from the childhood I described earlier, you know, having to find ways to stand out, having to find ways to kind of control a situation that may or may not be controllable. And then all of my work, even from early decades, again, working at Kmart with all different types of people, I've learned over all the decades now how to deal with every type of person. And there's, you know, there's only so many kinds of people in the world. Even though there's a bazillion people, there's multiples of the same type of person. So I can meet somebody and be like, yeah, I know you. I got you figured out before you even opened your mouth. And that's not a bad thing. It's just, you know, nice to be able to know. And I can also, I can gauge a crowd pretty easily. I just have that sixth sense. I can know how far I can go. I can push the envelope. Or if this is a crowd that's not really into that, well, then I know how to just entertain. I can find humor in anything.
Oh, and but they say they're not. They may say they're not into it, but they are.
Oh, they're into it. I have more often than not, I have crowds or different people in the audience that walk into an event not really there for it. You know what I mean? And by the time they're done, they say, oh my gosh, that was so fun. Thank you. I never met a drag queen before. I didn't know what to expect. Because a lot of the events I do, Michael, as you know, aren't like, obviously at Darcelle's I work, it's a drag show. But the majority of the events I do, I'm the only drag queen in the place. It's not a drag event. They just happen to hire a drag queen to host it. And so when people started doing that, it was like, oh my gosh, what are you doing? You're bringing a drag queen in to host this gala. Yeah. And now it's like, I don't want to talk myself out of a job, but it's almost commonplace. You know, now everybody does, and I love that. It's great for me. I feel like I've opened the door to lots of opportunities for a lot of drag queens. And just like you said, not everybody can do what I do. In fact, nobody can do what I do, which I've learned. But a lot of people can. A lot of people can host. A lot of people can talk. But there's only one me, which I'm very thankful for. And I, when people, you know, try to hire me for something and I'm already booked, often they'll say, oh, can you recommend somebody else? And I've learned the hard way. I really can't. There's no one I can recommend to do what you're hiring me for, because I've had more complaints afterwards where the people said, well, that person was funny, but they weren't organized, or that person was pretty, but they weren't professional, or that person, like, well, unfortunately, there's only one me, where I have learned to hone all those skills all at once. So
yeah, again,
it's a good thing for me, but not for others.
Part of that, you know, is being intelligent and reading the room, but I think being self-aware and vulnerable and, you know, laughing at yourself, I think is really important. I think, you know, I think the funniest people are often the smartest. Like, there's sort of an intellectual layer to humor.
Yeah, I totally agree. And people often, my biggest compliment that I hear the most, they're like, oh my gosh, you're so quick. You're so quick. Like, anybody can set up a joke and tell a joke, but to just react to something that somebody else said that you've never met, and there was no way you were going to know they were going to say that, to be able to turn it around and make it something funny and relatable for the whole room, not just that person. And I've learned that over the years, you know, working with people. It's, you can just get a room laughing just by saying, what is your name, where do you live, and what do you do? And just finding something smart and funny and quick to make that fun. I learned the hard way too, Michael, to not, you were smart just now when you said making fun of myself. I used to think the way to make the audience laugh was to make fun of someone. And I used to be really good at that. And I used to be really mean. And my smarts didn't fail me. I could be very quick and very mean, where everybody in the room was laughing except the person in that. So I learned that doesn't feel good. And that's not a way. I don't want my audience ever feeling like, you know, they were the target and the victim. So I had to realize that I can be fun and funny, but I could also still respect the audience, and I could also still know that they are there for me just like I'm there for them. So it doesn't do me any good to tear them down. So there's ways to be funny and engaging without being mean-spirited.
Yeah, I appreciate that. And then you don't want to be too vanilla either, because what good is a drag queen that's not sassy or snarky?
That's true. But, you know, I remember specifically I did an event for a group in Seattle, and they wanted a drag queen, but they were also, this was like, you know, I don't know if it was bank executives or whatever. And there were two gay guys. It was a couple. And they're like, oh, Poison, we're so excited to see you here. We saw you at something. And I'm like, oh, great. Well, then halfway through the event, they came up to me. They're like, are you okay? You're not as bitchy as we saw you at the last event. I'm like, that's not this event. You know, you have to know, because the audience was having a great time, but these two guys who had seen me in another element were expecting that. Sure. So I think that's another kind of great tool to have in your box to know when to be which kind of drag queen. So yeah. I always want to be me, but I also want to be, you know, I'm lucky that I can work with church groups or children's groups or school groups, or I can work with, you know, alcoholic, druggy party groups.
Yeah, so I can
work everything from A to Z.
Yeah, I love that. You know, and I've seen you reading stories to kids. Like, you know, there's so many different components of that. What I wanted to ask you was, how do you deal with people who have these misconceptions? So if, you know, either someone trying to grab you, someone asking you what's under your dress, someone who, like, doesn't understand that there's a difference between sexuality and gender and drag, like, how are you responding to people like that?
Well, fortunately, those incidences are few and very far between. I have to be honest, you know, when I very first started doing drag in the time when I was old enough to go to the clubs. That was all new to me, that idea. Like when I very first saw drag again, I was a teenager, so it was all, I don't want to say vanilla, but it was all for show. It was all on the stage, and I loved that. Well, then being out in the bar and bringing in alcohol to it, and I'm a single, young, cute, nude thing on the street, and there's all these guys, and like, hey, so I'm like, oh, okay. So I really did have a little brief moment where like drag and sexuality kind of did blur, and I was like, oh, wait, but this isn't showbiz. I mean, there was a definite like, okay, wait, now am I here for the show, or am I here for the fellas? What am I here for? And so I had to learn that quickly, that, you know, I want to be me, but it's not, there's nowadays, like, drag to me is the least sexiest thing ever. Like, to me, there's so much that goes into it. The armor, you know, everything you put on is like, how is that hot? And now they're definitely, you know, there's folks that it's a fetish for theirs, so they're interested in that, and that's good for them. But for me, that's just not what it is at this stage in my life. So I have always been a pretty approachable person, but at the same time, I can be a very direct person. So it doesn't take long for people to get what I'm thinking. So, you know, very rarely does somebody get very far with me in a way that I don't want them to. So there's not a lot of grabbing unnecessarily, and I'm also kind of a big guy too. So if somebody does kind of like put their hand, you know, like they're going to go to, you know, grab a fake boob, I can forcefully but gently move the hand like to my shoulder or something. You know, I don't ever want to, again, embarrass somebody and be like, you know, cuss them out or whatever unnecessarily. I mean, trust me, I have. But I don't need to do that just as a general rule. There's just some people, it's just ignorance. They don't know, you know, not everybody knows how to treat a drag queen. What is a drag queen? What a drag queen's about. And the fact that there are so many different kinds of drag queens, so many ways to be a drag queen, how are people supposed to keep track? Like maybe last week, the drag queen wanted that. So they think, oh, well, here's another guy in drag, so he probably wants the same, and I know.
Yeah. And then what about questions, you know, if someone asks you, like, I don't know, it sounds like people don't, and that might be because you give a kind reaction back. But if someone says to you, like, what's your sexuality, or why are you doing this? Like, do you get questions like that, or?
Not anymore. You know, early on, of course, late 80s, early 90s, when, you know, first of all, drag's been around forever. So especially in Portland, there's a long history all the way back to the 60s of drag in Portland. But for myself, you know, the late 80s, early 90s, you were like, what is going on? There almost was like a drag revolution. Like drag was everywhere all of a sudden. And then in the 90s, all the movies came out, Tu Wong Fu, La Cage aux Folles, all the different drag films, Priscilla Queen of the Desert. So okay, I think movie. The more the shows were, you know, the pop culture was finding drag, the more it was out and about, the less, I don't want to say ignorant in a negative way. People just didn't know stuff back in the day. So I think now I never hear questions like that. Everything is more like, where'd you get those shoes? Oh my gosh. And how many wigs do you have? Where back in the early days, people would say, are you gay? What does your partner think about drag or that sort of stuff? Where it's kind of like, well, what does that have to really do with what I'm presenting to you? But one of the things is I've never shied away from questions. I've always answered honestly. And I think that's where some people kind of trip themselves up when they try to, you know, sidestep the question or whatever. I don't have anything to hide. I'm not embarrassed by anything. So I think that's another thing, too, as you can tell. I rarely take a breath. I can just talk forever because I've learned, you know, when you're telling the truth, when you're speaking your own story, what's to think about? Of course, it just comes out. You know, I can answer anything because I don't have to really think about it or consider it because there's nothing I'm making up. It's all the truth. It's all what I've lived. So I think when people ask questions, you know, I have to assume they're asking legitimately. They want an answer, so they deserve an answer, and I give it to them. A lot of the shows we do at college campuses and like at the Elks Lodge and the Eagles Lodge, when we do those with ourselves, we had a lot of people asking, you know, questions just because they don't know, you know, how often does a drag queen waltz into your life and you have the opportunity to ask them questions. So I like that part.
Did you use the word wobbles?
Waltz into your life.
What's your thought on these shows? You know, like RuPaul's Drag Race, for example. You know, like,
I love it.
Yeah, because I don't know if you love it, if you hate it. It's sort of, I guess, there are people who watch it that feel seen, I'm sure, which is really helpful. So if you're in a small town and you see that show, you feel heard and you feel like you have a place. But then I also didn't know if maybe you seeing your profession in a competitive show also makes you mad. I know there are people who have that kind of viewpoint.
Yeah, no, I love the show. I love any opportunity for drag to shine in any light. I think there's always going to be haters out there. So no matter what you do, you're not going to please some of those people. So I think putting it out there, showcasing all of these kids, and I say kids because I still have yet to see a 52-year-old contestant on RuPaul's Drag Race, and I probably won't. But, you know, a lot of these kids are just coming out new in drag, or they've been doing it for a while in their community. I think it's fantastic. And I think, you know, there's so many different ways to do drag, and this show highlights all of those. So I think that helps, too, helps educate folks to be like, oh, wait, there's not just one kind of drag queen. You know, I'm sure back in the day, everybody thought to be Darcelle was the only way to do drag. And then as people started doing all the different kinds, then you kind of realize, oh, wait, there are all different ways. And it's nice to see the difference. You know, I love when there's the small town girl befriends the New York queen, or, you know, the one that clearly has all the glitz and glamour than the ones that are just kind of struggling along. That's true. And that's how it is out there. And I like that. I think putting drag in people's living rooms all across the country, in places where they probably never thought they'd see a drag queen walk down Main Street, and they may not, I think that's great. And, you know, some people who talk bad about the show, they don't like the competitive aspect. I think they're just being naive. Everywhere, every aspect, every drag experience is competitive. I'm competing with myself to be better than I was. I'm competing with the showgirls at Darcelle's. We all want to be, you know, the best in the show and get the most cheers at the end. I think competition is healthy. I think anytime drag can be seen in to a broader audience is great. I mean, there's nothing, I know some people say they miss the days when drag was underground and kind of edgy, and I never really got into that. I always wanted it to be mainstream. I wanted it to be, you know, like now I'm on the side of the TriMet buses and I'm on the TriMet bus bench, and people are like, oh my gosh, how is there a drag queen on the major city, you know, transit system? It's like, because that's just the way it is now, and I'm so pleased. I love that.
It's like you and Carrie Bradshaw from Sex and the City.
Yes, except the bus didn't splash me.
So what I wanted to talk to you about was Darcelle's and Darcelle. You know, how did you meet Darcelle? How did you end up working there? I know you and Darcelle have a very close relationship. You guys are neighbors, too. Like,
yes.
Is it, did you walk in and there was some sort of audition? Did Darcelle see you and was like, I got to have that bitch work here? Let me go and talk.
Well, the first time I ever saw Darcelle, so at this city nightclub, the underage club, I had ran for a pageant. They had a pageant for, like, who was going to be the head queen of the young queen, and I won. And Darcelle was brought in as the big, fancy, you know, dignitary to preside over the crowning ceremony. And I was like, who is this? Oh, my gosh, all the jewels and everything and the nails and the eyebrows and everything. And so that's when I first knew who Darcelle was. Then it didn't take long for me to know that there was a club called Darcelle's and people worked at Darcelle's. And I actually, that year, I wanted to know, because I had my job in retail, and I said that I was invited to ride in the gay pride parade. Well, this is where, you know, I was out as the gay man, but I wasn't 100% out as a drag queen. Like, everyone in my life didn't know that I did drag at night. So I was asking around, I'm like, what do I do about this pride parade? What if somebody sees me? Am I going to be on the news? And it's so funny to say that now, 33 years later, like, I'd kill to be on any news for any reason. You know, now I'm like, where's the camera? Where back then, I was like, oh my gosh, I'm nervous. What if somebody knows? So somebody said, go ask Darcelle. And it was so Wizard of Oz-ish. Like, little queen, if you want to know the answer, go to see Darcelle. And so I trucked myself over to Darcelle's. And, you know, I was underage, so I went in the daytime because they were open for business. I knocked on the door, and they let me in. And I'm looking, I was thinking there's going to be a throne and Darcelle sitting there with people fanning him with ostrich feathers. And I look up and here's this middle-aged old man changing a light bulb on a ladder. And they're like, there he is. I'm like, Darcelle. It was totally the Wizard of Oz. It was hilarious. He says he doesn't remember that moment, but I will never forget it. And basically I said to him, hey, this is what I'm thinking. He's like, only you know the answer. It was very Wizard of Oz. He's like, if you want to do it, do it. If you're afraid to do it, don't do it. Nobody, are you going to hide forever or are you just going to, you know, go for it? And he's like, I don't know your family or your job, or I don't know what is, you know, what you have at stake, but it's up to you to do your own thing. And so I ended up doing it. And that was, I think, the ego part of me was just looking for somebody with authority to give me permission. And now, as I just said, any media opportunity, I am there. So that's how I met Darcelle and we spoke. And then I worked at the Embers first, where, you know, queens would go, and I was at people's shows, and I hosted a show for a little while. Well, I remember Darcelle and his partner, Roxy, had said, hey, come in. We'd love for you to be in our show. And I said, okay. And so we came in. And we did some rehearsals or something. And they said, oh, no, the only thing is we just got to change your name. And I was like, huh? He said, well, Poison Water, that's just not like a real name. Because their name was Darcelle and Roxy and Laurel Andrews and Tina Sandell and these glamorous Lady Peacock, all these wonderful names. And they're like, Poison Water just doesn't sound like a nice person and doesn't sound like a name. I said, well, and this is, I mean, I was barely 21 and full of myself because I was, you know, the toast of the town. Everybody loved me at that point. And I said, well, then I'm sorry, I can't work here. You have to change my name. That I no, I don't want to be, what do my fans think? You know, of course, there was four people that knew who I was. I was so worried. So then I went back to the Embers, and then they called me again a little bit later and said, okay, if you want to be Poison Waters, because we'd really like you to work here. And so I did. And so I worked at Darcelle's. This is 1990. And so I've been with Darcelle ever since. Now, I didn't work as a full cast member. I worked for the first 3 years as a full cast member, and then I went off to seek fame and fortune on my own and do my own thing with the Rose Court and all the fundraising and just doing my own drag wherever I could. And I always hosted at least once a month or performed with Darcelle. So I was always there, just not on the payroll, being a guest. And I always hosted Darcelle's birthday shows and other fundraisers. It was early on that I realized and people realized that I had the gift of gab and I was a good MC. So even young, when I was a young drag queen, people would have me host their shows because they knew I could be funny and quick and keep the crowd energized. So then when I was done playing dress up and running around doing, I was with the Rose Court and being Empress and doing all this fun stuff. But I thought, well, I think it's time to go back to Darcelle's and be like a home base. So that was like 2004. And so I've been there ever since as the co-host.
What is Darcelle like? You know, I know we sort of know the whole Rhinestone Cowboy number. And I've seen whether it's good or bad, I've seen Darcelle's butt, I don't know, countless times. So, you know, is he funny, out of drag? Is there something you can share with us that is not confidential, that people don't know about him?
Well, I think Darcelle taught me so much, especially about, you know, being a media hog. There's nothing confidential about Darcelle. He has 3 books out, and he's had a play and a musical written about him because he tells everybody everything. So there's nothing confidential. But the thing with Darcelle is he's a very smart business person, and I think people probably wouldn't think he is, but they would realize after 54 years in the same space, especially in a town like Portland where things open and close right and left, the fact that he's still going strong. So he's a great, very smart business person. Like most show people, he comes alive on stage, but otherwise can just kind of be, you know, a quiet homebody. Like I, lately, especially during the pandemic, I have been loving sitting on my couch, talking to nobody, doing nothing, watching The Real Housewives, and I'll go over and visit Darcelle because we are neighbors, and he's just sitting on his chair in front of the fireplace watching TV too, and it's kind of nice. I mean, we all want to work, and we can't wait to get back to work full time, but when we're people that give so much of their energy to on stage and to strangers, there's kind of, you know, little left, and it's kind of nice to just sit. So when we go out and about, if, you know, I'll just say if there's someone going somewhere that has nothing to drag, if it's a shopping or a trip or something like that, he can be a little quiet. He can be a little shy just because he's out of his comfort zone. He's for, you know, 5 decades, he's been center stage of his own show under the spotlight, surrounded by his fans and his friends and his family, his employees. So when you get out of that, you can be a little like, oh, what do I do? Where do I go? And he can be, when we go, if we'll go to a meeting or we'll go to some event, and it's just, you know, we're dressed not in drag, so people don't really know who we are. He can be a little like, uh-oh, where do we go? What do I do? What's happening? And so he can be a little shy. He is very funny, always. He's always cracking jokes. And so I think people that are naturally funny just are always funny, even at inappropriate times. he's very emotional. He can get pretty worked up pretty easily, just recalling a memory or a time or a story. He's very generous. He's one of those people, he's very generous in a way that, like, if you need something, he will never say no. But he doesn't go around just throwing diamonds at everybody. So it's kind of a quiet generosity, but everybody, I think, that knows him knows that if anybody needed something, he would definitely...
Well, that's one thing I was going to ask you about, because I know that Darcel for years during Thanksgiving has done Thanksgiving meals for the homeless or anybody mm-hmm. who needs them. And I know you do a lot of community things, which is one thing that I really love about how you're involved with the summer camp. I mean, you're involved with so many nonprofit. Like, can you talk a little bit about that? Like, why it's important for Darcel or you or both of you to be so involved with the community and to actually have a community component to your business?
Well, I think for both of us, both being raised very poor, I know, like I said, all my family has been recipients of food and clothing and, you know, shelter, utility, lots of things that we were helped out with when we needed that help. So that just was an obvious thing for me when I was an adult to work with those organizations and to give back where I could. Now, of course, now it's the time where people, you know, hire me to work for these organizations, which is, that's great. But I still like to put them forward and give, you know, light and attention and give, that people know that there are organizations out there that helped me and can help people like me growing up. So I think there's the same with Darcel. He grew up really poor too. So being recipients of help when you're growing up kind of just makes sure you want to be able to give back however you can. And our platform being, you know, Darcel and being Poison Waters, we got a lot of people that listen to us. We got a lot of people that know who we are, and it's easy for us to, you know, give a little commercial to some of our great organizations. And, you know, the show at the club has been a hub for nonprofits for years. Great places. It's a great place for people to come and have a fundraiser or a show or a gathering. It's a great gathering place. Everybody knows where Darcel is. They know who Darcel is herself. And so being able to just come there and promote your nonprofit organization or raise funds for it, it's great. And it's always been, Darcel's always had a nonprofit fundraising element to his work, and I learned that too. So one of the great things I've learned from him, again, him being a very smart businessman, part of being smart in business is also being generous when you're able to.
Yeah. I wanted to ask you about, I don't know whether to call him your partner, boyfriend, husband. I mean, you're kind of like Andy and I, you're very domesticated, you know, and you have two cats. And you post amazing food pictures. I'm always jealous. So, what's it like? You know, I don't know if you can answer this because you're not the other person. But what's it like being in a relationship with a drag queen?
Well, so Jefferson and I have been together. It'll be 10 years in June, and we are registered domestic partners with the county. So we just call each other our partners. I think, you know, I've had several relationships. This is my for reals relationship, my adult relationship. And I think, you know, being, there's a difference between being a partner with a drag queen or being a partner with this drag queen. So I can tell you, and he'll tell you, it's at times taxing on the relationship, but it's also always entertaining and fun. We Jefferson being along with me, have access to a lot of great events. We get to do a lot of fun stuff that others don't get to do. We get a lot of things. People are very generous with us because of the work I do. So he benefits from that. I can also be very married to my work. So it kind of leaves him out in the cold sometimes because I'm very career driven, especially nowadays. I've got so much going on, juggling so much, and it's also important to me that I have to remember to save some time for him. Yeah, we're sitting at home with our two cats. You know, the pandemic's got everybody laying low. He works at home as well. He is a mortgage. What is he? He's a something about mortgage loans. He's an underwriter.
Okay, I was just saying, you better get that.
I don't know what he is. Listen, I don't go to hang out with him at his job, and he doesn't go to hang out with me at my job. That's what he used to tell people all the time whenever, you know, before the pandemic, he'd be at his banker's job in Hillsboro, and I'd be doing a show here or there. People say, where's Jeff? I'm like, well, he doesn't come to every drag show. First of all, that would be so boring. And I said, I'm working. You know, every event I'm doing is work for me. I said, I don't go sit on his desk at the bank, and he doesn't come hang out at the show. That would be weird, you know.
You didn't say sit at his desk. You said sit on his desk.
On the desk. I sit on the desk. Well, he's working away. I'm not sitting there with my legs crossed and my feather boa. So it's, you know, it just doesn't make that sense. So he, so now with being home for the last year, yes, I cook an awful lot, more than I should, and I'm so surprised that I make things. So I like to take pictures and post them, and then when folks make food for us or deliver things, I like to give appreciation to that on social media. So
I want you to know I'm not shaming that. I see biscuits, cinnamon rolls.
Oh my gosh, the biscuits and cheese.
I mean, just like
so good. I love it. Oh my gosh, it's delicious. And as a matter of fact, when we're done here, they get dressed to go. We're actually having dinner at Darcel's tonight. A friend is making dinner for Darcel. That's one of the great benefits of being Darcel's neighbor and longtime friend is I get to go along for the ride for some of the fun stuff too. So, yeah, I think the quarantine has gotten people cooking. And I've always been able to cook, but never just kind of whatever. But now when you have more time at home, we got to do that. Of course, that means we gained a little weight. And that's all right. The kitties love it. There's more of us to, you know, lounge on. And so we have a pretty good life. I'm pretty happy right now.
So we have a couple more questions. And then I have our five questions I ask everybody. But two more questions first. One of them is, can you tell us about the COVID drag pivot, you know, the most overused word, pivot?
Yes. Oh my gosh. So, I'm so glad you said that, because I always tell people, I'm like, I hate the word pivot. Quit saying it.
Yeah. So, you know, are you, I'm just picturing you with your wigs preparing for a Zoom call. Like, talk to us about that. Like, how did you early on, were you like, okay, well, shit, I'm going to make the most out of this?
No, well, early on, I said, well, shit, I'm screwed, because I was projected to have the most successful financial year, 2020, from all of my bookings. I always book everything way in advance. I have many, many, many clients that are annual events, fundraisers and whatnot. I work with McMinimins. They had opened so many more, so I was up to three or four different gigs with them a month, up and down, you know, I-5 in Washington and Oregon. Lots of different groups, new groups had brought me on, or brought me on in bigger capacities. So 2020 was going to be amazing. And I, you know, it was all forecasted in my spreadsheets because, you know, I'm anal retentive, and it was going to be wild. Well, then all of a sudden March 13th, everything shut down. And then March 16th was the last day of the world. And everything, I went to a zero. Every time my phone rang or email, it was a cancellation, cancellation, cancellation. And at first I was like, wait, what? And then by the time I was like, okay, whatever, I get it. You know, I can't be mad at these people. It's not their fault. So I stay so busy, Michael, but I like to say that I'm the laziest busy person ever, because I love doing nothing. I'm always going, 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 going to sit at my house with my feet up, the cats on my lap, watching TV. I love it. And so once I realized, there's nothing I can do about this. The quarantine's here. There's nothing I can do. All my events are canceled. I just leaned into it. And that's where I started with the cooking and watching everything on Netflix and just relaxing. And I had pivot. What? I wasn't pivoting nowhere. I was like, well, I'm going to sit here until, you know, things are back to normal. And again, Jefferson had a great career, so I wasn't worried about that. We weren't going to be, you know, homeless or whatever. And that was the other thing, too. I know, I mean, I make jokes about that, but I know there's so many people hurting so much worse, you know, that things. So I'm like, I got the least of my, you know, I can't even complain. So I just sat back and relaxed. Well, then a friend was going to have a birthday, and he's like, oh, I want to do a Zoom call for my birthday. And I was like, what is that? I don't even know what Zoom is. I never heard of it. And so he said, I want to do a drag queen bingo, because I've been doing that for about 20 years at places. And he said, what if you host drag queen bingo for my birthday on the Zoom call? And I was like, I don't even know what that is. That, okay, whatever. You're going to have to walk me through it. And so he did, and we had fun. And then all of a sudden, somebody else wanted one, and somebody else wanted one. And I, once I figured out that I could do it, because I'm no dummy, but I also don't, I'm not technically inclined, we'll say. And so I had, once I figured it out and realized it wasn't as hard as I thought, it wasn't as scary as I thought it would be, then the active poison waters, the marketing machine that I like to be, jumped into action. So I just started promoting the heck out of it and working with different groups. And oh my gosh, it has taken off now. I'm almost at 300 virtual drag queen bingo sessions since COVID-19 came and took all my money away. So it's been really great. And then a lot of the other folks who have had to pivot, the nonprofit groups who have hired me to host their galas and their fundraisers and whatnot, have brought me in to do that virtually. So either here for my dining room, or there's some wonderful studios in town that are doing a great job with their virtual galas and virtual broadcasts. So I've gotten to do some work like that. Again, I was so glad that the Drag Queen Story Times didn't go away. Lots of groups figured out how to still do that. So I work an awful lot from right here in my dining room. And you know, you said, yeah, getting ready and stuff like that. My favorite thing is that I only have to be in drag from the waist up. I make sure I have lots of great hair and a sparkle top and some jewelry, and then I can be in boxer shorts and bare feet, and I love it. I love it. Again, I'm lazy, so if I don't have to do all those stuff, it's comfortable and it's great. So there's that. I think some, you know, a lot of the queens have struggled. You know, everybody has to figure out what works for them. I tip my hat to the queens that have been running up and down the streets and in cars and doing in-person shows and driveways and restaurants and all that kind of stuff. I just, you know, that wasn't my reality. And once I landed the Drag Queen Bingo success and working with all my media partners that were helping me promote it, it was just great. So I didn't have to think beyond that. So then when the club reopened, that was so great. We launched a brunch that we never had before. We thought, let's get on the brunch wagon. And that's been extremely successful. Unfortunately, you know, we had to close again in November, but tomorrow we reopen. So we're back in action. I'm really excited.
Nice. Yeah. And we went there, Andy and I, for New Year's, not this January, but the January before. Mm-hmm. And so when this January hit, we were like, oh yeah, that's where we were. We were at Darcelle's. That was a year ago.
Isn't that wild?
So last question for this, and then we have our five questions. So this is it's not meant to be a downer, but you know, I know that you've lost a lot of people to AIDS, to sickness. I mean, there's a lot of people. So, can you tell me about that a little bit, about that time, and then how you deal with that, or how you move forward, you know? And also I know that our generation doesn't necessarily understand a lot of what happened. Mm-hmm. And so there's this question of how do we, as I say, we, I don't know. I'm older. I mean, I'm not your age, but I talk about myself as if I'm 20. I'm not 20. I'm in my mid to late 30s, but you know, there are kids today that I'm hoping they understand not just the AIDS crisis, but about the history of gay rights, how it wasn't always like this. So I know that's a big question towards the end, sure. But can you just give me some feedback about that?
Sure. So again, you know, when I came out in the late 80s, early 90s, that was the height of the AIDS epidemic. And it was something. I mean, again, like no one knew what it was. No one knew what was going on. Coming off of the 70s and 80s where everything was party, party, fun, 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 it was kind of like, oh my gosh, now the party's gonna stop. And I was just coming out going, I haven't even got, the party hasn't even started. What's happening? And all of the people, again, having been drawn naturally to older people, all of my drag queen friends were older than me, at least, you know, if not 5, 6, 10 years older than me. So they were all the folks that I ran around with and, you know, hung out with and did the shows with. Well, then I would start seeing them slowly disappear inside themselves. You know, people got complete, their physical being just completely changed when they got sick. I had a lot of friends that would go be, you know, they would go home to wherever home was, whatever Midwest town or where else in the country they came from, and people would just disappear. And one weekend, you know, who's, where's so-and-so? Oh, she died, or she moved home, or she's in the hospital. And it was really just kind of this horrific reality that none of us could comprehend, and that we've had this feeling that we were helpless. There was nothing we could do. And we were talking about fundraising and whatnot earlier. That's where the drag queens really took to fundraising and doing what we could to help our fellow friends, our showgirl friends that were, you know, suffering and dying. If we could help them, you know, pay their rent or get them groceries or do fundraisers for memorial services and burials. So it was really it's undescribable what a terrible, horrific time it was. And folks these days, you know, young folks don't understand, which it's not their fault they don't understand. It's up to folks of my generation to keep the stories alive about our fabulous friends. So I like to tell more about the wonderful people that helped bring me around to be Poison Waters than not so much of how they went on to die. And so there's lots of education to be done. And I think some young folks are hungry for that. And so I'm always inspired when I meet new queens and that what they want to know, you know, what happened? Where are all these girls that you talk about? Or where are all these people that are on the walls of Darcelle's? And the stories of the Embers, you know, what happened there with all the fun people and great things. So it was a really, it was a time to really learn and reflect and grow. And I don't, you know, we can't change anything. So all I can do is be thankful that I had that time with my friends that are no longer with me, and I got to learn from them. And I hope that all the work that I do going forward is, you know, in their name and to help them stay, be remembered. My work with Cascade AIDS Project, now over 20 years, is, well, actually over 30 years, I've been working with HIV-affected children's camps. This will be our 21st year that I've been working with them. And just really everything I do with the AIDS Walk and the art auction, I just always remember my friends that are no longer with me.
Yeah, well, thank you for that. Sure. I'm sure they're, wherever they are, they're watching down and seeing how fabulous Poison is.
Some could be looking at. I had some rowdy girlfriend.
You said it. I didn't say it. So, okay. So there's our five questions I ask everybody. So the first one is, if this wasn't your focus right now, you know, or your career, what would be your passion project?
Well, I always wanted to be a high school music teacher. I have great memories of my high school music teacher, my band teacher, my choir teacher. They were both wonderful, wonderful folks who did a lot for me, just not even in music, but just in school and, you know, to navigate the awful time that high school can be. You know, sometimes it's just not fun, and they were both really there for me. And I was always blown away by their talent of how they could just, you know, my band teacher specifically, he could play any instrument. He would just, when he was trying to show a student something, and I was like, how can he play every instrument? Anyway, so I always thought I would be a great high school music teacher.
Yeah, you absolutely would. What's something in your life other than your given or chosen family that you know will always bring you joy?
drag, you know, audiences, strangers, you know, it's interesting. Some of my friends and family have been like, you care more about those strangers than you do about us. And I'm like, that's not really true, but I feed off of the energy of strangers so well. And so I think there'll always be strangers, Michael. So I'll always have a new audience somewhere.
I thought your answer was going to be chocolate cake.
No.
What are you binge watching or reading right now?
I am supposed to be reading a therapy book that my therapist told me to read that I have on my nightstand, and I've only read a couple of pages. I am currently watching all of The Real Housewives. I always watch them, and right now, Dallas is back. New Jersey just started. Salt Lake City just wrapped up, so I'm still trying to process that. So anything on the Bravo network, mostly The Real Housewives.
Is there, like, a pandemic version of that?
Of The Real Housewives?
Yeah.
Like, well, actually, yeah, now the new episodes that are coming out, they're dealing with, like, they have masks and they're being tested and quarantined and that sort of thing. Yeah.
Okay. When the world goes back to, I don't know, normal's the word, post-pandemic, right, where would you want to travel first?
Well, I love New York City, and I have been going to New York City for, I don't know, since about mid-90s. Often in the last several years, I got to go, you know, every year and go look at lots of fun theater and shopping and stuff. So I definitely would like to do that. I love cruises. Jefferson and I have been on several cruises. And so that seems to be like ground zero for this sort of thing. So probably not the first place we should go on. But yeah, I would like to go on another tropical cruise or go visit New York.
Cool. If you were to give a TED talk, what would you talk about?
I would talk about myself. I would talk about how I became to be a strong and confident, successful entertainer, having come from being a shy, not confident, poor child. and also I would throw a little in there of how you can find happiness and laughter in any situation.
I appreciate that. And then finally, who would you like to give a shout out to? So a local business, a local organization.
Oh my gosh. All I know there's businesses. A lot. Well, of course, you know, Darcelle's, I always tell people, you know, we've been there for 54 years because we do a really good job. Darcelle and all the folks do a good job. It's a great place to walk in and just forget the cares of the world, and a great place to celebrate, you know, whatever there is to celebrate with your family or friends or coworkers. Small businesses in town often fold, and the first thing you see is people saying, oh, I wish I would have went there. I always wanted to go there. Oh, I meant to get back there. And I always tell people, quit saying that. Just go. You know, Darcelle's is there, and we need to. Darcelle's 90 years old now. He's done such a wonderful job keeping it alive. We can't let it, you know, fold now. We can't let this stop us. So I always tell people, Darcelle's. We have shows 4 nights a week and the brunch, and it's really wonderful. So we'd love for people to come check us out. Also, who doesn't want to see the 90-year-old drag queen, the Guinness World Record holder? Come check it out. And also Cascades Project, you know, they are built from the first pandemic, you know, HIV and AIDS, and they have been soldiering on through all of this. And, you know, at a time where their clients, they, you know, they can't see their clients right now. They can't be in person, and there's still, you know, folks that need in-person care. So CAP's been doing a wonderful job to keep their organization thriving and running and keeping all of their clients taken care of. Our HIV-affected children and their families, the camp that we work on, we were able to pivot, there's that word again, and go from an in-person camp experience to a camp-in-a-box experience where each kid got a box delivered to them that was made just for them and filled with all kinds of camp activity things. So I wanted to give a shout out to Cascade AIDS Project and all the hardworking staff and volunteers there.
Well, that is all. I really appreciate you a lot, you know, because you're a real person. And I think, you know, you could have been like, I'm Poison Waters. Screw you all. You know, like you maintain, you know who you are. You maintain that down to earth quality. You do a lot for the community. So you inspire me a lot. I really appreciate it.
Thank you so much, Michael.
Yeah, and I really appreciate you taking your time to do this podcast. I know you have a lot on your schedule.
It's my pleasure. I was happy to chat with you. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Okay, great. Have a good rest of your day. Enjoy
All right.
whatever you eat. I mean, hopefully we see pictures of it.
Oh, my gosh. It's going to be... Well, now, though, so our friend is cooking. And so, you know, I tend to, unless it's just at our house, I don't really like to post because then too many people get judgy saying, what are you doing at our cell's house? You're not supposed to be there. But I can go there. We're in the same bubble. Anyway. Yeah,
the pod. They call those pods, I think.
Oh, my pod, not the bubble. Okay, it's a pod.
You know, yeah, but... Enjoy it. Enjoy whatever you're eating.
I sure will. Have a great night and enjoy your weekend.
Thank you so much. Take care.
Thanks. Bye.
A very big thank you to Kevin Cook, aka Poison Waters, for being on this episode of the podcast. To find out more about Poison Waters, including social media and booking information, visit poisonwaters.com. Again, we want to extend a sincere thank you to X-Ray FM for the 2020 X-Ray Award. Check out all the good work they're doing at 91.1 FM, 107.1 FM, and online at xray.fm. And thank you for checking out this episode of All of Your Business. You can visit us at allofyourbusinesspodcast.com for previous episodes, sponsors, and much more. Be sure to subscribe to the podcast and share with your friends. This episode was recorded at JJT Studios and edited at Track 11 Music.